Among Books is a show where we talk about reading and more. It's recorded in person at Hilltop Books in Northwest Philadelphia. I'm Stephanie Marutis of Kuvenda Media, and on this episode, I chat with Pennsylvania State Senator Art Haywood. Senator Haywood represents the state's 4th Senate District, which covers Northwest Philadelphia and Eastern Montgomery County. For more about Senator Haywood, please check out the show notes, where you'll also find a reading list based on our conversation. Senator Art Haywood, welcome to Among Books.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here. And we're certainly amongst a lot of books right now.
That's right. Yeah, you were here for the ribbon cutting ceremony, as I understand it, 4 years ago, April 2021.
Yes, my wife Julie and I stopped by, and it was a fantastic ribbon cutting. I looked a lot at the political science section, which was very strong.
What do you gravitate towards typically when you go into a bookstore? Where do you start?
Some of it is the books that are more front-facing that you can see because they figured out how to make you see those books.
That's right.
And that's good. Sometimes I go to travel because Julie and I like to travel. I study political science, so I often go to political science or history section. I'm very light on the fiction. Mm-hmm. I seldom go to fiction section. So, that's pretty much the direction I head in.
So, pretty substantive material.
Yeah, I probably need to read more fiction because I'm a big believer in imagination. Mm-hmm. You know, and the bigger our imaginations are, we can do more problem solving. But yeah, I'm pretty much a nonfiction guy.
I see. What might you be reading these days?
So my wife gave me the book on Supreme Court Justice Jackson, so I haven't really started that. I finished a book called Dying of Whiteness, which is about how identity can get people misaligned with what's important to them, like an identity for guns. You know, if you're in a gun culture and then people are committing suicide, you know, that's a challenging combination. So it was mostly about identity and the impacts of identity on day-to-day life. But I read the Bible a lot. I probably mm-hmm. read the Bible a few times a week. I focus mostly on the stories of Jesus, mm-hmm. not the Old Testament stories. But I get a lot out of those stories and the parables. Mm. I got a book on Gandhi, a short book on Gandhi recently. And I'm reading some of that. My pace is not that great.
All of our attention has been diminished. I don't know if you feel this way. I can see the difference in my ability to just sit there and focus because of having a smartphone and every other message zinging at you.
I think that's absolutely right. Our concentration levels have shifted to much more short term and slowing down where you can get the level of concentration is challenging, but it's really important because so much of, at least in the area of politics, you know, so much of our work can be informed by mm-hmm. what's happened before. And so I'm a really strong believer that there's a lot of historical insights you can gain from reading.
Tell me about you as a young reader, because it seems like history, political science is where you've landed, and I'm curious where it started.
So my mother, probably around 6 or 7, some probably around there, during the summers would take me to the library, the local library. I grew up in Toledo, Ohio, which has a strong public library system. Mm-hmm. And we would go and get books, and then about 2 weeks later, we'd drop them off and get another set. And so we would go through this routine every summer, probably till I was about maybe 14 or so. And then it was sports, mm-hmm. right? So that, but I got a love for reading there. And I think what I was reading then was basketball biographies.
Yeah.
I remember I had the Walt Frazier biography. Mm-hmm. That was fantastic. And some travel stories. But that's how I got started.
So your mom, she was driving your reading habits early on, the frequency, right?
Yeah.
Back and forth to the library.
Yeah. That's very much the case. Now, my mom was a public school teacher.
Ah.
So that is a lot of that story as well.
And it's interesting how you're saying, you know, sort of then you got into sports. What kind of sports did you play?
I played basketball in high school. I tried to play basketball in middle school, but I was cut.
Really?
Yeah, so that didn't work out. But I did play basketball in high school, so that was a lot of fun.
You made up for it.
Yeah. That's a good characterization. You made me feel better.
Well, good. I'm glad this is therapeutic, too.
But, yeah, I still follow basketball, women's, men's, college. I like college more so than the professional because the intensity of the college players is so high.
I agree.
Yeah, it's like every play counts. But I haven't read many basketball books in a long time as we think about it. Now, in terms of biography, it's mostly politicians, history of this nation, history of the other nations. There's some fantastic books on presidents, what they have done. I do encourage people to pick up biographies on the areas of career in which they have an interest, because then you can see the path that some other people took that you may end up taking or at least considering.
Yeah, that's a great tip. I mean, because then you get a flavor for the decision-making, the process. Really good tip.
Yeah. And it's particularly if you come from a household that doesn't have the experience that you're seeking or the direction in your life that you're thinking about heading, that's a way to get it through someone else's experience.
It's a resource. And coming back to what you said earlier, imagination. You're a big believer in imagination. So we'll talk about your political career, but I know literacy is one of your main priorities. And ever since you came into office, starting in 2015, you moved quickly in that area. Tell us about that.
So I had three children. They're all adults now, but we had a big belief in literacy and reading. Every summer when they were probably up until middle school, we had a reading contest. When they were really young, it was how many words you would read, then it was how many books. So I'm a big believer in education, and my family has been committed to education. So I was an advocate in Sheldonham Township to try to reduce the achievement gap, which was significant, particularly in 2005, in that kind of period. And it was clear to me that unless our children had better access to education, they're going to fall further and further behind. So when I got into the state Senate, we compared the reading proficiency in Montgomery County parts of my district with the Philadelphia parts of my district. And I looked at reading proficiency for Sheldonham and had been tracking that for a number of years as a kind of a parent advocate. But the disparity was dramatic. So we had third graders in Abington and Sheldonham, maybe 5% would not be proficient. On the Philly side, some of my districts, it was only like 5 or 10% that were proficient. So it's complete opposite. So it was clear to me that something needed to be done. It was clear to me I wasn't the superintendent.
Maybe behind the scenes, but
You know, or a principal or something like that. So Maisha Jackson is a good friend of mine. We decided we would do summer reading camps. And we were able to get several of the recreation centers in the Northwest to include summer reading in their normal recreation program. So several agreed to having two mornings a week where we'd have a tutor and they would help the young people read. This was fortunately at the same time as the Free Library was doing their Read by Fourth initiative. So we were able to join in with the Free Library, which provided books, some level of instruction for the tutors, for the teachers' tutors. And so that was the beginning. And I do want to share that Senator Vincent Hughes was a fantastic partner with me after getting started in a few years. And so we went from the 6 or 7 recreation centers to having a program that was from 8:30 to noon, 4 days a week. So that was something Senator Hughes and I were able to put together. So I don't want to give anyone the sense that any of this is done alone.
Yes.
This is not like a soloist kind of thing. The soloist doesn't really work in my experience, particularly in politics. But I do certainly want to mention Senator Hughes as a big assistance, a supporter and initiator. And now over 2,000 children have participated. Every report I saw was that they were not suffering from the summer slide. We could prevent the summer slide, which is a terrible experience in terms of falling back and reading year after year. We turned the program over to Mount Airy USA from my office. Mount Airy USA had a Reading Rich Neighborhoods initiative, much more staff, much more capacity. And so now Mount Airy USA is leading the summer reading program that we started. We called it the Reading Revolution at the time because there was a need, and even now, and I would say at a revolutionary level, actually.
How do you see literacy sort of as part of the lifelong journey as being a citizen?
Without literacy, I think it's very difficult for folks to have a life that's productive. Also, in my first year in the state Senate, I met the guy over the Department of Corrections, John Wetzel. And John Wetzel was, and I think is, a leader in trying to get people out of prison and rehabilitated to avoid recidivism as well. John said to me he would be able to reduce the prison population by half if folks knew how to read.
Wow.
I was stunned. Yeah, I said wow as well. So that's an amazing assessment of who is in prison. And he was in a position to know, right? He's over the Department of Corrections. So that was a significant magnitude in terms of literacy, that lack of reading is a real contributor to incarceration. So that's one testament to the value of reading and literacy. The only other thing I would say is that to really assess what's happening in our world, in our country, a lot of the sources of that information are only available from reading. Television is okay, social media is okay, but there's some questions that require reading to answer because it's just more in-depth. I got to say another story about a Republican colleague of mine who was the leader of the House Republicans, and he said every summer he would read one book that had a view totally opposite of his. Totally opposite. So that he was in a better position to take into account other views. Now, some of my colleagues probably would say he never really took account of their views, but nevertheless. But
the intention was there.
That I thought was pretty significant. And I don't know many people who actually do that, to really be able to hear the other side, not just hear from the other side in terms of sound bites, but to hear what the other side is thinking, I thought it was extremely significant. So reading helps us to take more into account than we could do otherwise.
Just wondering what your work reading is like. Probably read a lot of reports and maybe you hear a lot of testimonies that then you read in a transcript. But tell us about what reading for work looks like.
Yeah. So reading for work for me is a lot of it is daily, which is newspapers, online newspapers, to see what's happening here and around the nation and around the world. That's a lot of the daily reading. Then there are other reports from various agencies. I'm on the Health and Human Services Committee, so we're frequently getting reports on a range of health conditions and concerns. Most of that reading for me is executive summary as opposed to the whole report. I am very fortunate. I got a fantastic team that can do more in-depth. And that's a lot of it. Reading reports, reading the paper. You know, is social media reading? I think it's more glancing, you know. It's like more surfing headlines, I guess, as opposed to reading. But I do some of that as well. I would say that's the main activity. But in addition, reading biographies is still helpful. Reading history is still helpful. I read a fantastic book on the civil rights movement, like Methods, looking at the civil rights movement as a war and the war tactics, strategic. I'm taking a second look at that because I think there are some strategies that were in the civil rights movement that can apply to our situation today, which I would only know from reading.
There you go. Comes full circle.
Yeah, I would only know what strategies worked, what didn't work from reading. This is not a biography that I'm talking about. It's nonfiction analysis of a movement.
Tell me a little more about that.
About that book?
Yeah. I don't know that one.
I can't remember the name of it. As soon as I get the name, I'll get it to
you. We'll get them later, and then in the show notes, we'll put all the titles.
So it takes a movement-by-movement assessment. So first assessment is Montgomery bus boycott. Then they do the sit-ins. Then he looks at the freedom rides. And then he looks at Selma, you know, the Bloody Sunday episode. So what he does in each one of them is find strategic war approaches and applies them, probably selectively, but applies them to the campaign. And campaign's a good way to describe it because, you know, there's war campaigns, and these are like Montgomery bus boycott was a campaign. So what he says in Montgomery is, number one, the strategy for selecting buses was so strategic because it aligned the power of the black community, where they had a lot of power, with a bus company that was largely subject because most of the riders were black, as opposed to a different target, say a restaurant or say a department store, where there was more diversity of customers. And so the power, applying the power, would have been less effective. And that is a consistent approach. That's one of the strategies that I recall that he mentioned consistently, is identifying where there's a maximum power that can be applied, he says, to the narrowest target. So doing that now would require us to say, for those who don't like some of the things that the current president is doing, would not be an attempt to go after everything. If you have this much power, you can't go after everything, right? So you got to look at the power that you have and then apply it to the narrowest point of impact. So I'm looking at that question now, the citizen disobedience strategy and how that can be applied now. So, well, we'll see how that all evolves.
We're going to take a short break now from our conversation and turn it over to Amy Wilson. She's the executive director of the Friends of the Chestnut Hill Library and manager at Hilltop Books, where we record the show.
We're a used bookstore run on book donations, so it's volunteer staffed, open 6 days a week, and it's run by the Friends of the Chestnut Hill Library. All of the books in the store are just a third of the retail price on the book. Proceeds from our sales benefit the Chestnut Hill Library. So we support programs at the library, we support the book collections, and we also help out with building maintenance and advocate for the library system as a whole. We love volunteers. There's a range of volunteer opportunities, from working in the store to helping us with pop-ups and special events, and our volunteer intake form is on our website.
For more about Hilltop's hours, location, and volunteer opportunities, log on to hilltopbooks.org. And come join us at the bookstore for a party to celebrate Among Books on Saturday, October 11th from 3 to 5 p.m. Get a chance to chat with some of the people featured on the podcast, including Pennsylvania State Senator Art Haywood. Refreshments and light snacks will be served. And if you like walking and hearing scary stories, don't miss a very special ghost walk with Hilltop Books on Saturday, October 18th. Live storytellers will be sharing tales along a short route from the Chestnut Hill Library to the bookstore. For more details and to sign up, log on to hilltopbooks.org and click on events. Now, back to our conversation. You know, what I keep hearing from you during this conversation is that you're a student of history and you look maybe at the world as a historian in a lot of ways. Is that fair to say, perhaps?
Yeah, I try to find historical insights. So there's pieces of American education that I believe devalue historical insight. So I was very fortunate, and the reason I share this experience, I was very fortunate. I graduated from London School of Economics for graduate school, right? Very much historical approach. This is a long time ago, right? I'm old.
But not that old.
So this is like the late 70s, early 80s. In America, while we're looking at historical insight in Europe, and that's not all Europe, but at least the LSE, the Americans are almost all looking at statistical analysis, which is all current. So it's not what can the past tell us about the future. It was more so, what can these polling numbers, what can these statistics tell us? That's a different approach to problem solving. But, you know, we're really into polling here, right?
Yeah. Nonstop. That's the American way.
Yeah. Poll after poll after poll. As opposed to what insight can we gain from the past about conditions that we're in now? What do our current conditions about economic insecurity, what do those historical conditions tell us about what might happen as opposed to a poll?
That's right, because it's there. It's on the record. We know the history. And if you take time to look at it, you can glean and make inferences. And
exactly. You
can't predict it, but you can have a sense of, okay, this might play out this way. It may not, but...
And the predictive powers of polls, you know, are very challenging.
You must hate polls.
None of them are truly predictive, but they can give you a range of options and for decision making. So yeah, I would say I'm a big believer in historical insight.
Maybe that will be your next literacy initiative, is elevating history even more.
Yeah, yeah. That's maybe in my next phase.
Yeah. You have written a book, Campaigns for Compassion, that preceded your official, more or less, political career, but you've always been in the arena of politics. Tell us about this book and what it's about.
Sure. So I start writing chapters before I thought it was going to become a book. A good friend of mine, Phil Lord, my former law partner, told me I should write a book. But my first chapter is on the challenges of public education in Cheltenham, which I've described briefly was a significant achievement gap. But we had a good effort. We formed a parent advocacy group, and we were able to get the school district to reduce some of the tracking that it had. So one of our core aims was to get children into the highest level of rigor, because if you're in a rigorous curriculum, classroom, you're going to learn more than if you're not. A lot of our kids were not. They were in low rigor classes. So we're successful in doing that. So I tell the story of advocacy, as well as our second campaign was to reduce the disparate treatment in terms of punishment. We were able to do some of that. And I got a chapter on my first campaign, which was for township commissioner in Cheltenham, and then my second campaign for state senate, as well as some of the things I was able to do in each of the roles. It's done. It needs to be rewritten dramatically because it's too long. But I was glad to do it. And I don't know if it influenced me in terms of going into politics or not. Actually, I don't think it did. I think basically I was trying to tell the story of some of the work we had done from neighbors who were just trying to make change. The parent group that was the key advocacy group for trying to reduce the achievement gap was about 7 to 9 parents. My campaign committee to help me run for township commissioner was about 7 to 8 folks. And my state Senate campaign in 2014 was about 7 to 8 folks in terms of core. So that was one of the things I try to share with people. You know, you get 5, 7 people that are core, a lot can be done.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting that you say that, because actually during my conversation with Lauren Cristella, we talked about a book that she and I happened to both read called The Art of Gathering by Priya Parker. And she talks about being intentional about gathering, but she has a part about the optimal sizes for different gatherings and making decisions. And that 6 people is a sweet spot. But you've, again, historian, you've seen through the different work you've done that that's a recurring pattern, sort of having that number of trusted advisors around you.
Yeah, at least that's my experience. But I'm glad to hear it was confirmed by someone who knows more about it. But yeah, that's my experience with it. And a lot can be done with a small group. And once I got into the political arena and started to see how other folks were organizing their efforts, it's pretty consistently a small group.
Well, given that you just talked about getting into the political arena, take us back and what your pathway was to becoming an elected official.
So I have supported a number of candidates for office who consistently lost. I supported Jesse Jackson in 84. He lost. Jesse Jackson in 88. He lost.
Yeah.
Ralph Nader. He lost. So I had a long, unfortunate record of supporting at least presidential candidates who did not win. My wife and I were thinking about who to support for president in 08. I started off with John Edwards because he had a big anti-poverty agenda. Mm-hmm. And most of my career has been trying to reduce poverty. You know, he had some kind of affair or something like that.
So yeah,
that
he did have a scandal. Unfortunately, it comes with politics. Not everybody, but yeah. Unfortunately, yes.
So that was kind of the end for that one. And then I started looking at Obama. And he was dynamic. He was saying a lot of things. Some of my friends had heard about him. I think when I was in law school or shortly after that, he was... was he editor of Harvard Law Review or something like that? I think we heard that. So we knew something about him from my early kind of legal career. So we said we'd try to help him. So we did a fundraisers. We got yard signs. We start organizing phone bankings and then canvassing. In politics, when you're a volunteer, I got a big promotion. And so the promotion was to be canvassing captain before I was canvassing coordinator. Now, this is for the Cheltenham area, Abington. The promotion meant I would work more weekends, more hours.
Here, you just went up.
Yeah, that was more work. Yeah. But when he won, I said, hey, something positive can happen in government. Mm-hmm. So some friends of mine and I, we decided somebody had to run. We all decided that it would be me to run for Township Commissioner in Cheltenham, and Kathy Hampton, who was also very involved with the campaign. At that time, the Board of Commissioners was all white men and had been since the founding of the township. So we won, and that's how it all began.
So sort of in the spirit of the Obama campaign was, you know, the theme of change.
Yeah.
And so you brought that to Cheltenham.
Yeah. My campaign was called Cheltenham for Change.
There you go.
At the time. So I do tell people now that I am basically an Obama volunteer. So people an orientation to how I see it, how I got involved. I ran for state Senate, and that was after there had been some really bad flooding. I think it was Tropical Storm Lee at the time. And there was a lot of concerns about the responsiveness from the state senator at the time. So I decided to run, and really surprisingly, I won. Now, I was completely surprised when I won for township commissioner as well. And I was very surprised when I ran for state senate. When I won, I was stunned. You know, I had a private practice. I had cases, mm-hmm. right? And so I'm like trying to work these cases. After I won, I said, I just got to try to avoid malpractice because I still have these deadlines.
Yeah.
Now I got to transition. But yeah, both for me were very, I mean, I worked to win.
Of course.
But I was very, very surprised.
Well, what were the polls telling you?
So I had a poll done, I think, in March. I think the election was in May. I think I predicted the poll in March. I had 15% support. And I remember going to a consultant that was connected to the Wolf campaign, and Dwight Evans, who's a friend of mine. Mm-hmm. And I remember asking him, this is after I got the poll. I said, what are my chances? Mm-hmm. He said, 15%.
What you see is what you get.
That was an election with three candidates, but yeah, that's what the polling said. Now, that was in March, and the election was in May. But I would not say I had any historical insights that helped me.
That was pure polling for that one. Yeah. Oh, David versus Goliath story.
Yeah, maybe. But it worked out. Yeah. It worked out. And, you know, we are now in year 10, and we're doing all we can.
The one big question that we ask on this podcast about influential books, the ones that have had impact on people's lives. So I was wondering for you, you know, what might be some of those books that have influenced how you think, act, live in the world?
I would say primary would be the Bible. Like I said earlier on, I'm a big Bible reader. The stories of what Jesus had to deal with and didn't deal with. I read a lot of the historical Jesus stuff that's outside of the different theologies. So I try to do that. When I was in graduate school or maybe college, I can't remember, I read A Crisis of the Negro Intellectual by Harold Cruz. That was so liberating because Harold Cruz was willing to critique a lot of the Black advancement strategies of the 60s and 70s. And it helped me to be more independent in terms of thinking. Yeah. Yeah. He was critical of King. He was critical of Malcolm X. Right.
So, you don't see that perspective as much, right? You know, in the literature.
He was like, here are the limitations of this strategy, limitations of another strategy. So for me, it was very liberating not to be in camp and having more independent thought. So that was big. After Crisis of the Negro Intellectual, so I read a lot of W.E.B. Du Bois and Dusk of Dawn, which is one of his many autobiographies, was very influential. It was mostly written around the 1930s, a lot of it in terms of asking the question, how do we respond to the Depression? And it was mostly a Black nationalist perspective of how we can gather our communities together. Although Du Bois is like Mr. Integrationist, right? I mean, he's like...
At that time, for sure.
Yeah, that's how he is known. But he had views for the times. So he's very much trying to end segregation, but also said, hey, there's some self-reliance strategies that we need, which was helpful to see because the characterization of someone from, you know, the first 20 years of their writing can be very different than the last 20 years of their writing. So to see the change, I don't know if it's evolution or not, but to see the change was also helpful. For me, also freeing. Mm. Not feeling that you gotta stay in whatever lane that you started in. The importance of growing.
Mm-hmm. That's so evolution.
Yeah. Those are definitely evolution. So those are some of the books that I would say. My wife is helping to put together a Black History collection for our church, Salem Baptist Church. So we put a bunch of these Black History books we have at home on the table. And we start saying, what we can share, what we cannot share.
Mm-hmm.
So once we got most of them, unfortunately, we decided we cannot share.
they're like gems. Yeah.
But it did help me to recall. I was looking at some of my favorite titles there.
These books, too, it sounds like you read them at a formative age.
Yeah, I would say so. Yeah. And that's relevant. Yeah. I think later I was reading a lot of Civil War. So I read a lot of Civil War books probably in my 40s and 50s. Yeah, that was my Civil War period. But yeah, those were more formative in terms of how I thought about myself, how I thought about the world.
Just having this conversation, it makes me think about what are the books we do want to read that we haven't read. And it might be in the spirit of reading a different perspective, but also personally, I revisit a lot of books in a way because they're like reference points, mm-hmm. you know, but I'm kind of feeling inspired by this to, okay, what can I read that is out of my normal comfort zone, perhaps, or just the tendencies?
I haven't really done it on any consistent basis, but forcing yourself to do it so you can take other positions into account, I think it would have a dramatic impact on how we see ourselves. I mean, you're reading more, you're taking different experiences into account, so your impulse can be reduced because you've got to take more into account. Sometimes decision-making can be slowed down because you're trying to take more into account. But in governing, I think reading is really important, not just for historical insight, as I've talked about, but also to hear the other side. And this is not a new environment from the perspective that there's a bunch of different people who have power. Right? Power is distributed. So the more you need powerful folks to be aligned to move in the agenda forward, then having some appreciation of what they want and need, where they're coming from, can make the conversation so much better. Yeah, I mean, it's just getting some appreciation of rural Pennsylvania, I think is critical for anything you want to advance in Pennsylvania, because it's not like taking those interests and concerns into account is going to work. Mm-hmm. When I say work, you know, get the votes to win. It's like, yeah, these voices count. These people count.
Before we wrap, is there anything that you wanted to talk about that we didn't touch on?
I would only like to say that part of our summer reading camp was founded on the quote from Frederick Douglass, which was, if you can read, you will be forever free. And my experience of reading is consistent with that quote. There's a freedom in reading, not just because, you know, I became a lawyer, we got to do a lot of reading, or I'm in politics now where we do a lot of reading. But it's more to the point I made earlier, which the reading helped me to get the independence of thought that personally is very valuable.
Well, thank you for sharing that with us, because you're right. No one can take that away from you.
There it is. Yeah, that is exactly right. And it's a foundation for so much more.
Senator Art Haywood, I want to thank you for joining us on Among Books.
Thanks for having me. I got a lot more out of this than I thought.
Well, very good. Spread the word. Among Books is mixed by Brad Linder and produced by me, Stephanie Marutis of Kuvenda Media. And a final special thanks to the Friends of the Chestnut Hill Library, its executive director and Hilltop Books manager, Amy Wilson, and the many volunteers who make the day-to-day operation of the bookstore possible. Until next time, happy reading.